on the sound, KJR Seattle, in our 60th year of broadcasting. And now, more of our birthday special. Rolled into Seattle, the city was undergoing some big changes. SeaTac Airport was completed at the cost of $13 million. King County's post-war population had risen to 800,000 people. And Boeing was busily at work on its first commercial jetliner, one that could take you from SeaTac to New York City and back in the light of one day. The area's prosperity was witnessed by two statistics that came out in the 1950 census. Seattle had more electric ranges and hot water heaters than New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and San Francisco combined. Downtown shoppers were treated to some new expansions during the decade. While browsing through one of the five new floors at Frederick and Nelson, a fashion-conscious lady could buy a wool winter coat for just $39. In 1958, down the street at the Bon Marché, which had just added three floors to its existing building, the man of the house could pick up a no-iron, Van Heusen shirt for $5. And 1954 was the year when the elegant new iMagnon opened its doors at 6th and Pine. Out north of town, a new suburban area was under construction, and with it, a magnificent new shopping center. In 1950, KJR's microphones were there, checking on the progress. Note that this was in the days before I-5, so the announcer had to give some pretty precise directions for you to find Northgate.
Yes, this is Operation Northgate, a documentary program designed to show, step by step and on the scene, how a great city expands through imagination, willingness to take a chance, know-how, and hard work. Those sounds you hear in the background are the sounds of heavy construction being brought to you by wire recorder as I stand on what will be the first floor of the largest unit of Seattle's North End Colossus, the Northgate Shopping City. As the weeks progress toward the fulfillment of this $12 million dream, this program, Operation Northgate, will bring you rivet by rivet, beam by beam, and mold by mold, the story of the erection of this huge, ultra-modern shopping city just north of the Seattle city limits. Here's the simple way in which you may come out to check the progress of this development. From Seattle, I merely drove out Roosevelt Way, then south 10th Northeast to east 105th, then I turned left and proceeded five blocks to 5th Northeast. There, the tremendous development is located, bounded by east 103rd, east 110th, 5th Northeast, and 1st Northeast.
Seattle suburbia wasn't the only one growing during the 1950s. All across the country, people seemed to be flocking from the inner city to outlying areas, which offered less crime, more trees, lawns, and the supposed good life. Part of that new good life must have been the opportunity to have a backyard patio, and in turn to invite all the neighbors over for barbecues. Americans had lots of barbecues in the 50s, as the sale of those cookers tripled in the decade. And subsequently, so did the sale of lawn furniture. And some ingenious guy made a fortune by selling the lawn ornament of the years, the plastic pink flamingo. Socially in suburbia, saw the kids grow up. The children of the baby boom were growing into school-age kids. So with them came a huge surge in the number of little leagues, Cub Scout packs, summer camps, and of course, schools. And the toys were bicycles, roller skates, and hula hoops. For the parent of those years, besides going to church and attending PTA meetings, the new social phenomenon that swept the country was called the cocktail party. Vodka and gin sales between 1950 and 1960 quadrupled, and so did the number of cocktail lounges offering happy hours. And not surprisingly, the amount of aspirin sales went from 12 million pounds sold in 1950 to 18 million pounds sold in 1960.
In some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue, the plan that all began with cocktails for two.
KJR during the early 50s was owned by Ted Gamble, who purchased the station from the Marshall Fields Company. We were still an ABC affiliate, but the days of radio network programming were numbered. KJR's music format varied widely, and included in it were a mix of classical tunes and even country and western music.
You cheating heart. to leave.
But the majority of the music played on KJR came from the popular songs of the 1950s, which grew out of the big bands and featured many former big band singers with the biggest hits of the day, like Doris Day.
Once I had a secret love.
Millionaire.
And Johnny Ray had a song that could have been about Seattle.
Just walking in the rain.
'54 was a big year for Rosemary Clooney.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Why?
Patti Page had one of the biggest hits of the decade with this.
I was dancing with my darling.
And the man that changed the sound of music with his electric guitar, Les Paul, teamed up with wife Mary Ford in 1951 for this hit.
Somewhere there's music, I'll play the tune. No matter how high
the moon. The hits in the early part of the 1950s were usually sweet and syrupy and were offered by such names as Andy Williams, Vic Damone, Johnny Ray, Dean Martin, Frankie Lane, Judy Garland, Sarah Vaughan, and many others. The average age of the record-buying public in the 50s was somewhere around 25 years old. So the demand for records was for a smoother, more adult sound. But there were some exceptions. Like what Les Paul and Mary Ford left us. Drop in popularity in the late 1940s, the voice was back in the 1950s, especially after he starred in a movie called From Here to Eternity, Frank Sinatra.
You vowed your love from here to eternity.
Sinatra was back not only making records, but also buying radio stations, one of which was here in Seattle. In the mid-50s, he purchased KJR.
I've got you under my skin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.
Hi, this is Frank Sinatra wishing KJR a very happy, a big fat birthday. KJR Radio, a big part of Seattle for 60 years. Congratulations, KJR, on 60 years in the great Northwest.
KJR Seattle, celebrating our 60th year of broadcasting. More of our special coming up. KJR Seattle, celebrating our 60th year on the air. And now, more of our birthday special.
At the beginning of the 1950s, some were beginning to wonder if whether bomb shelters would soon be a fixture in every American home. A new anxiety swept over the world as the nuclear race between the U.S. and our latest aggressor, Russia, heated up. By 1950, the Russians had three times as many combat planes as America, four times as many troops. But more importantly, Russia, too, had atomic weapons. So thousands of Americans were digging up their backyards in hopes of finding protection underground. American concerns about the communists were validated at the dawn of the new decade as Red troops rolled into South Korea. On July the 1st, 1950, President Harry S. Truman sent troops into battle. And for the second time in 5 years, we were at war. Soon after, a power struggle between the White House and General Douglas MacArthur ensued, as MacArthur wanted to bomb China. But Truman didn't agree, and MacArthur, the head of U.S. forces, was fired.
The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away.
By 1953, a truce was signed in Korea, and U.S. troops began arriving back home. Over 500,000 of them would take their first steps back on U.S. soil here in Seattle. And Second Avenue downtown was turned into Welcome Lane. Returning troops had to travel down Second Avenue on the way from the docks to Fort Lawton. Along the way, smiling girls handed each man flowers that were donated by local florists. And office workers in tall buildings shredded paper and gave the men ticker tape parades along the way. A big welcome was also given to a new president in 1953. Dwight Eisenhower became the foremost personality of the decade. Although many liberals and intellectuals didn't like his friendships with business tycoons and his noncommittal views on such controversial subjects as school integration, the voting public liked him in a big way and said, "I like Ike." His vice presidential running mate in 1952 was Richard Nixon. Nixon spoke to the nation.
Pat and I have the satisfaction that every dime that we've got is honestly ours. I should say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And I always tell her that she'd look good in anything.
During the 1950s, the stage was bringing us some fantastic music. The most memorable songs came from three plays in particular. The Sound of Music. The King and I.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you before.
In the 1950s, Hollywood was dishing out new sex symbols and a new teen symbol by the name of James Dean. He was every teenage boy's inner vision and every girl's dream. His image was best summed up in the title of his most famous movie, Rebel Without a Cause. James Dean lived only long enough to make three movies. On September 30th, 1955, he was killed in an automobile accident. But his legend lives to this day. The sexiest female star of the decade gleamed from platinum blonde hair.
I want to be loved by you, just you, nobody else.
She had a walk that was hard to find words for, and a voice that sounded like this. To some, Marilyn Monroe was just a dumb blonde bombshell. But several movie critics said it was clear to see that after each performance, she was maturing into a talented actress. Publicly, she was the decade's sex kitten. Privately, she was complex and insecure. Other names dominating the movie arcades in the 1950s were Marlon Brando, Rock Hudson, Liz Taylor, Kim Novak, Tab Hunter, Tony Curtis, Brigitte Bardot, and Sophia Loren. But even with all the stars, the movie industry was hurting bad. Movie palaces of the 30s and 40s were closing left and right. The reason was that people were going to a little box in their living room for entertainment instead of to the box office. Television had grown from 3.1 million sets among U.S. households in 1950 to 32 million sets 5 years later. And by 1959, the average U.S. family was spending 6 hours of each day in front of the tube. Soon, not only movies were feeling the crunch put on by TV, but radio, which had been thriving on popular network comedies, music, and drama, was having its very existence threatened by the new media, which offered both sight and sound. The hit shows that had adult TV viewers huddled around their sets in the 50s included The Andy Griffith Show, The Milton Berle Show, I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, The Ed Sullivan Show, The Honeymooners, Make Room for Daddy, Dobie Gillis, Gunsmoke, and My Three Sons. And there were the kids shows that had a generation watching television. There was Captain Kangaroo, The Mickey Mouse Club, and Kukla, Fran, and Ollie. And if you grew up here on the Puget Sound, what an array of local stars you had to choose from. Like the late Ruth Prince. Ruth began her career on television as the story lady on Televenture Tales from Channel 5. The show started in 1950 to be followed by the Wonder Wonder program in October of 1953. The series ended in 1972 as a Pulitzer Prize winner. Another very popular children's show, and one of the first in the Seattle area, was Stan Morrison. On the air for more than 12 years, playing his accordion and singing with Scandinavian accents. Over the years, he made hundreds of personal appearances all over the Sound. Here's the song that opened his program every afternoon at 5. This in particular was the last time he would sing his theme on television, December the 28th, 1967.
Hi there, gang, and there's Snowball dolled up. Hey, you's here. I'm here, and we're going to have a great meeting today. This is our last meeting in the clubhouse. We're sure sorry about that, gang, but we're going to have lots of fun today. Are you ready? Here we go. Zero Docker, Hoochie Rocker, Calabaloo's a bump. That's the secret master that we use down at the club. Zero Docker, Hoochie Rocker, Calabaloo's a fan. Now you are a member of King Stevie Club with Stan and Nomo and Hayes, Paul Vernon, Graham, Stormwell, Phineas Frog, and all the clubhouse gang. And we're going to be hearing from just an awful lot of the clubhouse gang today, too. We're going to show you some of the things that we did years ago on film and we looked much younger than we do today.
Brakemanville was a show that used a model train setup as an identifying gimmick. An MC was supposed to be a young fellow called Engineer Walt. But just before the first episode went on the air, Walt contracted polio, and a Channel 11 cameraman by the name of Bill McLean was drafted almost at the last moment to fill in as Brakeman Bill. The rest is history, and this was his theme song. Possibly you remember this music. Originating in the mid-50s, every afternoon on Channel 4 was Captain Puget, as played by Don McKeown.
Of course, the live kid show personality was the thing, which seemed to be part of a kid growing up. He identified with at least several of the ones he was looking at all the time, to the point that now, years afterwards, I have people coming up, you know, their mothers that have children either in their arms or at their side, or the patrolman who stops me for going a little too fast and signs his ticket a Captain Puget fan or something like that. They remember, and it got to be kind of a standing thing with the crew of Exploration Northwest, because wherever we travel throughout the Northwest, why, someone somewhere along the line would come up and say, "Hey, I remember you when I was a kid."
Channel 7 was the last TV station to go on the air in the 1950s, and the first live show on the station was J.P. Patches. J.P.'s show coined such colorful characters as Tyke Turkey, ICU-2 TV Set, Sturdily the Bookworm, and of course, the famous Esmeralda. Talking about the show's early days, here's Chris Wiedes, who plays J.P. Patches, and Bob Newman, who plays Gertrude and Ketchikan the Animal Man.
Cairo had not signed on the air. You guys are celebrating your 60th birthday. Well, Cairo TV signed on in February of 1958, and that was the first show. The first live show was my show, and it was on a Monday. I forget the exact date. I think it was February 9th or something, and it was on at 10 o'clock. That was the first time we signed on. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and Mr. Slick was a character who was on my show then, and he sold me the city dump. That was the first show. I had just retired from the Dingling Brothers Circus, and I was looking for a place to stay. And Mr. Slick sold me the shack.
Because of television's tremendous success and influence, by the mid-1950s, things were looking pretty dim for radio. Ratings were dropping. The stars of the once-hot radio network shows were switching their allegiance and contracts to TV. And radio advertising dollars were dropping at an alarming rate. But on the horizon was a new revolution in radio, innovations in music, and a new chapter in the KJR story. We'll take a look at that in a moment.
Ooh, I love that girl.
A disc jockey in New York named Alan Freed called the new music rock and roll,
and the first charted rock and roll record was G by the Crows. And then in 1955, a new group skyrocketed to number one on the charts with a song called Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your flat right so. Join me, hot.
Changing in the 1950s, and by 1955, with a growing youth market that was now starting to buy records, two men, one in the Midwest and the other one in the South, began a new radio format, where disc jockeys would chatter with the latest lingo and introduce the top records of the day. They'd play the top 40 selling songs in order, and when those were over, they'd repeat them in the same order. The format was called Top 40. Todd Stortz pioneered that format in Omaha. But a man in Dallas by the name of Gordon McClendon developed it into its modern-day version. Gordon McClendon believed in strong personalities, exciting contests, and a hustling news image. Before 1955 was up, his Dallas station, KLIF, would wipe all the other stations off the ratings map.
Weird Beard, KLIF in Dallas, 1190, and I love you to death. And I want to say before I leave, we've been kind of goony and crazy as every night, but as I leave you, once again, Dallas, thank you so much for putting up with me. I love you very much. God bless you.
Here in Seattle, KJR was sold in 1954 to a man named Lester Smith and a group of other investors, among them Danny Kaye and Frank Sinatra. Smith heard of the success of KLIF in Dallas and flew there to talk with Gordon McClendon. In 1955, he brought back a program director, moved KJR to its present transmitter site in West Seattle, and started playing the day's top-selling records. KJR became the first rock and roll radio station on the West Coast.
My car, but when I